The World Tomorrow, as recorded before a live audience in a nationwide speaking campaign, Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
I'm here to tell you that the tiniest little country in Lilliputia land someplace on the entirety of this earth that would begin to institute as national policy obedience to the Ten Commandments would soon be number one in the world. You couldn't keep such a nation down. A nation that would believe in the absolute integrity of the home. That all authority and all government, that all values in society of giving, loving, sharing, begin in the home. The nation that would make it a crime that a child is not taught a trade from his father. The nation that would make as its platform the Ten Commandments. And administer that law would be a nation you could not hold down. And it would very soon become number one, because such a nation would be a nation truly under God, indivisible, with justice for all. It would be under God. It would be God's nation. Any nation that voluntarily began to keep the Ten Commandments, even in the letter. Let's go back and say that even if you talk about the pre-New Testament days, and you take the Ten Commandments in the letter, along with the laws that had to do with agriculture, which includes, of course, capital punishment for infraction of the letter of that law, I'd still make the same statement. People would be in harness to laws that are actually living and that have benefits and consequences which are automatic. The laws of the land. They would begin to experience fabulous weather and good crops. It's amazing how people want to persecute some of these small little religious organizations, like, for instance, the Amish people and the Hutterites. Yet there have been studies that have been made of some of those people to find that there is no such thing as divorce among them. I don't necessarily agree with their religion, but they sure have a right to it. But I'll guarantee you one thing. One offshoot, or call it a spin-off, of their religion because of their belief in moral integrity and their very strong belief in the home unit is that they have virtually no divorce, if any at all. I'm not aware of any. They have no mental illness. They have basically good health because they believe in an agrarian kind of a society and living on the farm and close to the earth. There is no theft. People can leave their valuables. They can leave their homes unlocked. They can trust their neighbors. Now, of course, the average person in the United States would feel they're very chic and they're very tough and they're very know-it-all. They don't need God. I mean, they're self-sufficient. They're able to take care of themselves. But really, deep down in their heart, they want their neighbor to keep the Ten Commandments. It's just they don't want to keep the Ten Commandments. It's like the TV commercial we did one time for the television program. Maybe you saw that one. I guess somebody else has done it, but it shows some guys rummaging around in this apartment, and they're stealing a color television set and a lot of silver and everything and quickly putting it in a box, and they put it on a dolly, and they carry it back outside, and they look, and they can't believe their eyes. Some dirty crook jacked up the back of their car and stole their rear tire. And here they are with all this stuff they've stolen out of the home, and some filthy crook stole their tires, ripped them off, made them furious. See, even a dirty, rotten crook wants his neighbor to keep the Ten Commandments, but he doesn't want to keep them. He wants everybody else to keep them. Every filthy criminal in the United States would just love it if the United States were a commandment-keeping country except for one. He'd have a free hand. He could go and steal from everybody and never fear that his car would be ripped off while he was still in your color television set. But even crooks tend to quarrel between and among themselves. Sometimes they double-cross one another. There is a way by which we can have peace. Peace in our homes and families by living the kind of a life that Jesus Christ spells out for us in the Bible. That has to do with the way families ought to be constructed. That has to do with the structure of father and mother, and believe it or not, it is in a vertical structure. No matter how that appeals to young girls of today in the feminist movement and the idea that mom's place is absolutely not ever in the home. What they do is dad washes the dishes and changes the diapers on Tuesday, and she does it on Wednesday, and it's his turn again on Thursday. And probably he then gets an extra day or two on the weekend while she's out playing golf or tennis or maybe taking a business course, learn how to manage the business. And we think that is going to give us happiness and success. It gives us double incomes. It gives us more affluent. It gives us a second automobile, that's for sure. It gives mom more clothes. But have you seen one of those very lengthy televised documentaries on teenage crime recently? The reports that came right out of the mouths of these youths, they had a very incisive one on teenage gangs, because the big cities, Chicago, Detroit, New York, the city of Houston, Los Angeles primarily, well, they have all of these gangs. The Puerto Rican groups over in New York City, the blacks in Harlem, the ones out in Watts, and the ones down in the various parts of Los Angeles where Chicano Americans live. And they're not all just various minority groups, too. They're made of every cross-section of society in the United States, whites alike. And those kids, one after another, just said, well, in answer to the question, why are you here on the street? Why are you hanging out? What they do, they just congregate on a street corner, 6, 8, 10 dozen of them. A little later on, some guy happens by, and they begin to push him. And he says something, and so they hit him. And he says something again, and so they stab him. And it's just that simple. Well, then the cops show up. So then they have the cop down, they grab his gun, maybe they kill him with his own pistol. And then maybe 5 police cars show up, and they got a great big neighborhood shootout, and a whole bunch of them are jailed. And then, of course, they're promptly turned loose. Nobody saw exactly who did it. But in a survey, they had even parked a van, and they had, I guess it is infrared methods by which you could very dimly see, and you got to see on this one telecast these youthful kids on a street corner in, I believe, New York City, literally stab a man. Now, thankfully, it was so vague and it was so murky, you really couldn't see the actual stabbing. But the commentator was telling us, while you're watching this, just these people kind of shadowy, moving around, kind of struggling together in a knot of people, that one of those kids had a knife and a person was very critically injured. Now, they will answer the questioner, well, what were you doing on the street corner? Well, we didn't have nowhere to go, man. Like, I mean, there wasn't nothing else to do. We're just down there just hanging around, wanted to see what was going to happen. That's right, there was nothing to do. What was at home? Maybe a mother, maybe not. Probably not. She's probably to work it. I imagine 80% of the waitresses in the United States are divorcees with children they're having to support. I imagine a tremendous percentage of the women or the female labor force of the United States have children at home they're trying to support, or they wouldn't be forced to work, because oftentimes they either don't know who the dad is, or suspect they know who he is, but he won't do anything to help him support the kids. You'd be amazed at the rate of illegitimacy. It's up to 50% in some of the big cities. Every other baby born in Chicago is illegitimate. So you give 10, 12, 14 years later, and you got a 14-year-old boy or a 14-year-old girl, and he has grown up on the street, and his friends are pimps and harlots and hustlers and muggers and thugs and drug pushers, and he doesn't have any values at all about society. He doesn't care about your property. He doesn't care about your pain or your aches. If you're an elderly 65-year-old lady with arthritis and just barely make it on a little government check, and you're creeping home because you went down to the local dairy store to get your milk and eggs for tomorrow morning, he doesn't care about your life. He doesn't care about your body, the way you hurt, the way you ache, the fact that your grandkids are out somewhere else hundreds of miles away earning a living. You got their pictures on your piano. No, he'll kick you in the head while he grabs your purse and stomp on you as he runs. Because he's an absolute animal. And because this country is not as far away from the jungle as we like to think we are. Because our cities are more dangerous than the jungles in Africa. You can walk on the street in the Arab section of Jerusalem more freely than you can walk on the brightly lit streets along the Avenue of the Americas in New York City. It's a statistical fact. You can do it. You can have more peace of mind. You have less fear. You feel nothing's going to happen to you walking along the old city of Jerusalem late at night all by yourself. You're not in any danger. No one's going to bother you. Teddy Kollek, whom I have interviewed, the mayor of Jerusalem, told me that on the television program, that statistically, they just don't have that kind of a power. Oh, yeah, you read about a riot over in Hebron or somewhere, politically motivated or religiously motivated because of the Palestinian problem against the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and all of that. But that's quite different than it is, because my own son lived and worked over in Jerusalem for a long time and had many friends among the Arabs and was alone over there the whole time and had no problem whatsoever. This country of ours, a spoiled country, a wealthy, rich country, 6% of the populace of the world living in 50% of its wealth, has the gall to want more. We want more, and we demand it. And our leaders do every kind of fiddle-footed, beautiful little hopscotch minuet all around the issues, doing anything they possibly can to lure the voters into voting for them with the ideas, the promises, and the programs that are going to give us more. You don't make enough money, you want more. You don't have enough insurance, you want more. You work too many hours, you want to work less. But that gives you more because you have more leisure time. And you want longer vacations. What is it we really want out of life? Well, we want basically food, shelter, clothing, but we want luxury. We want fun. We want excitement. What do you not want to happen to you the rest of today? I noticed that we've had some problems because of automobile accidents. We saw one person here that had been in a terrible wreck just this morning. It happened very recently with broken limbs and so on. Now, people don't want that kind of thing to happen. You don't want to go home and find out that your car you left there has been stolen. You don't want to go home and find out that your living room has been rifled and broken into, that your personal clothing or your costume jewelry or whatever is gone. You don't want to go home and find out your silver is gone or the painting on the wall is missing. You don't want to be cold. You don't want to be hungry. You don't want to be uncomfortable. You don't want to hurt. You don't want to ache. But you want to feel good. You want to feel healthy and strong. You want to have an alert and a clear mind. You don't want a blinding headache. You want to be able to see and not be blind, to hear and not be deaf, to walk and not have to cripple along because of aches and pains. We all want the same things. We want to live, and we want to live happily and successfully. And there is a way by which we can do that. Laws that absolutely guarantee it, and a way by which one nation can live at total peace with another nation, which is called the way of peace. And the Bible says nations don't know the way of peace. Now, let's just reason together for a moment and admit a few things which I think are obvious, that can't even be arguable. I know a lot of people would argue with this, but they're wrong. They just are. The Soviet Union wants peace. I'm going to get a lot of arguments out of a lot of people's minds if I say that, which I'm saying publicly. The Soviet Union, meaning the people of the Soviet Union, the peasants and their strong young kids out mowing the grain in Azerbaijan, the people over in the steppes, perhaps of Byelorussia or the Ukraine, the people way on out near Irkutsk or outer Mongolia someplace, want peace. They want to live in their communities with their daughters around. The grandparents pull out his little balalaika or something like that and get the music going, and the girls in their bright colored skirts, and have their little native dances the way they have done for generations. Those people's lives, the peasants of Russia, have virtually remained unchanged all the way from the Tsars clear down to the revolution, the Bolshevik revolution, until today under Mr. Brezhnev. Their lives are unchanged. They live close to the land. They don't know much about the United States. They only know what they are force-fed by communist propaganda under government-controlled radio and printed media. But basically, if they were to get together with you face-to-face, eye-to-eye, man-to-man, they would be about the same kind of people, and they would want the same thing. Remember Soyuz and our own orbiter that docked together in space, and we had three of our astronauts, and they had two of their cosmonauts, and they were strong, young, good-looking men, as were ours, and they were up there cooperating in Skylab, conducting experiments, orbiting around this Earth together in cooperation between two Soviet cosmonauts and three American astronauts. I remember so well going down to the sports arena when the Soviet gymnast team, following, I think, a couple of Olympics ago, Olga Korbut, gold medal, and she, along with Lyudmila Tereshova and some others who, at that time, of course, were the real champions in gymnastics, were touring the United States. And they came down to the sports arena in Los Angeles. And I believe it was Whittier College and some others down there, Irvine and some other comparatively small ones, but they had a track team and they also had some gymnasts there. It was quite a track meet. And it was an impressive thing because they first played the Soviet national anthem, which I had never heard before. But it was quite stirring. And, you know, you do listen to Tchaikovsky, and they have names like that, and some of the great composers, believe it or not, were Russian. And you can't just hate everybody because they're a Russian. I don't think you ought to hate a Russian just because they're a Russian. I don't think you ought to hate them because they're anything. And so they played both national anthems. And they had these two teams of athletes, these Soviet female gymnasts and these young American men with their track suits on at the other end. And at the end of it, The Americans walked forward as good Soviet gals, and they met right midway, and each one of the men presented one of these Soviet girls with a beautiful wreath or a bouquet of red roses that they were holding. And that was the opening ceremony for this big track meet between the United States and the Soviet Union. And I thought, well, now that was tremendous, and that's the way nations ought to compete. It was quite a moving ceremony. And they did a magnificent job. There was nothing, of course, more fabulous. That was the two top gymnasts in the entirety of the world at that time, Tereshkova and Corbett. And it was just breathtaking to watch them perform. It was competition. That may have been post-Olympics, but nevertheless, we were quite pleased to be able to see them. It's shocking to say that the people of the Soviet Union, who speak a different language, want peace. But I happen to believe that is true. I honestly believe that their leaders want peace. But peace to them has a completely different connotation than it does to us. I believe the United States people are a peace-loving people. I do not really want to believe, though I suspect as I look around that H. Rapp Brown might have been partly correct years ago when he said, violence is as American as apple pie. I don't want to really believe that, and yet when I see television and entertainment and look in the newspapers and see what's going on out in the streets, I tend to think that maybe he was quite right. I look back at the history of our own wars and what we're doing to each other and the crime picture in the United States, and I sometimes believe that he might have been right. But I still do not believe that we are a war-loving, a war-mongering people. I don't believe that we exult in war. I've seen the reaction in that longest and most costly of all of our wars, Vietnam, and the way we reacted to it. And you can't say that the United States citizen is a war-loving person. We are not. By nature, we hate war. As a matter of fact, we demand that we remain number one, that we don't have young people who are the stuff of legions. We do not expect our young men to go into the armed services and fully expect to fight and to die if necessary. Our armed services are supposed to be the beginning of a career. They're supposed to be halfway house for a lot of kids who got in trouble, and it beats going to jail. It's a good method of going out and learning avionics or electronics or engineering or something else, and then to take a place in civilian life with a pretty good background in some type of a trade. But to be expected almost like a legionnaire to keep the peace around the world, the American temperament is not such today that we would send Marines anymore to the shores of Tripoli. And now, like Monday morning quarterbacking, people were attacking the administration, the Ford administration, for the Mayaguez incident. It is so easy after all is said and done to attack and to claim that they could have done something else. But of course the ship was gotten back and the crew was rescued. But young Americans died in the doing. And so it's easy to criticize. The United States of America, we say, is living at peace. But the world is not a peaceful place, and the immediate offing, the immediate future in this world is anything but peaceful. The announcements that have been made recently are almost enough to curl your hair. They include the fact that I mentioned earlier that the Soviet Union has now reached strategic superiority, not just parity. They include the fact that there have been millions upon millions of people who have died in one of the worst droughts to come along in the sub-Sahara, and now finally that drought moved, as I said it would, in the early 1970s. I said in the mid-1970s, we're going to have severe drought. And I said it before tens of thousands of people. It was based really upon scientific reports of the cyclical character of these droughts, but it was also backed by the fact of what it says in Revelation, in Matthew 24 and Luke 21, in the words of Christ himself, who said there will be droughts and famines at the same time when the potential for the destruction of humankind is with us. I didn't realize the drought would be worse than the last 100 years. I thought it might be worse than the 1950s. And maybe not quite as bad as the Dust Bowl of the 30s. Little did I realize it would be far worse than the 30s in England and Europe, and so bad in parts of the United States and even the central California Valley, where about 42% of the vegetables that we consume in the entire country are produced, that it would be drying up the subsoil so bad that even permanent crops such as walnut orchards would be cut down for firewood. I didn't realize that then on the heels of that would come these ravaging floods and washout roads in desert areas. And that the Mississippi River would come down to a little kind of a muddy stream where a lot of the boats and the barges are left high and dry. I just said we're going to have a drought, but I didn't know how bad it was going to be. Why did I say that? Because I know that the United States of America is under a condemnation from Almighty God, because we are not a commandment-keeping people. because we have lost righteousness, if we ever really had very much, and we are losing what little bit we had. The so-called Protestant work ethic is a good ethic. It is a right ethic that a person ought to earn his bread by the sweat of his brow, that an honest, hard day's work deserves an honest day's wage, that a person ought to be thrifty. The word square is very unpopular today. If somebody is square, he is kind of an icky creep of some kind. Where the icky creep who is standing around, you can't even see his eyes, he looks like an Australian sheepdog through all the hair, he is supposed to be in. I don't know what he's into or what he's been into, but I know what he ought to be into, a bath. But anyway, the time used to be when a person who was square was a square shooter, was a square dealer. He would make you a square deal. He would sit you down and feed you a square meal. And you could trust a person like that because you're dealing with right angles. You ever seen people, though, that will talk about somebody and say, without saying it, you know, and they nod? That's really bad news that somebody is supposed to be square. But we are losing that righteousness, what little bit we ever once had. And those ethics, and those mores, morality, that we've heard a lot of, even from politicians lately, and basically morality is right, and it is correct, and it's good to want to be right. Nothing wrong with wanting to be right. But you know, human beings want to be right without doing right. And you can't make yourself right just by wanting to be right. You have to do right. So this 59th chapter of Isaiah is an overview of national politics and of international government all around the world. Verse 8, the way of peace they know not, and there is no judgment in their going. They have made them crooked paths. Whosoever goes therein shall not know peace. What do you believe your chances are for the next 5 or 10 years? With all of the myths in which we believe, with the incredible rise of despotism, with the disintegration of freedom, with nation after nation descending into a new dark age of totalitarian dictatorship, where ham-fisted, iron-fisted rulers such as Idi Amin, Daddy, or as he calls himself, Dada, Idi Amin, is able to obliterate a university, and there is no government, there is no force, there is no one in his own nation who is going to rise up against him. Now, of course, the dictator can't sleep too easily. He's got to have a duplicate limousine, and he's got to have a double, and he's got to sleep in a different place each night, and he's got to be careful not to advertise his movements in advance, and he's got to be surrounded with a trusted group of bodyguards whom he doesn't really trust. Did you hear about that one African organization conference up in, was it the Sudan years ago, where I believe it was, I forget which nation it was, whether it was Dahomey or, in this case, maybe the same one in Tebbi down there in Uganda, but almost every member of the entire government and an entourage of about 3 aircraft were commanded to go to that Organization of African States meeting because the dictator in charge of the country couldn't trust the one of them to stay behind. So he took the entire government with him so he could watch them, so there wouldn't be a coup d'etat while he was gone. He didn't want to go back home and find out somebody else had taken over the country. Freedom is virtually disappearing from the earth. And every single time you find one more of your personal freedoms being trodden upon or being taken away from you, it makes you wonder. There are already enough laws and restrictions on the book, so far as the average American person is concerned, about what you can and what you cannot do and what others can or cannot do to you, that it's almost unbelievable. Do you know that, for example, in the state of California, if a man enters your private home, and you still have the right as a citizen to bear arms, and you've got a gun there, and if you shoot him, you had better prove that he had a gun pointed at you, number one. Secondly, you'd better be able to prove that he fully intended to use it. That's difficult to prove. Thirdly, you'd better prove that you used every means at your disposal, meaning you fled from the living room to the bedroom, and he pursued you there. You can't shoot him in the living room, because you obviously were not hiding out in the bedroom. Then you flee from the bedroom to the bathroom, and he pursues you there. And then you go from the commode to the shower and hide behind the curtain, and he pursues you there. If he is draped over the bathtub, bleeding from a chest wound, with a smoking gun in his hand, and you have a wound somewhere, you might avoid going to jail for assault with a deadly weapon. But only if you prove all of those things. And let me tell you, if you make a mistake and he scares you half out of your wits, beats up on your wife, maybe injures your children, and steals something, and turns to run, and you shoot him in the back, you're going to go to jail for assault with a deadly weapon or attempted murder. And as a matter of fact, I've heard of cases where people even behind bars in jail have been able to try to get lawyers to sue banks for taking their picture while they were robbing the bank without their permission. That's a fact. That actually happened. There was some farmer up in Iowa that had sign after sign on his property, do not, you know, trespassers, keep out, gun traps, so on, do not enter, this place protected with a gun. And I guess he'd set up one of these shotgun traps or something. And some dirty crook disobeyed all the signs and rifled his, opened up the door and blam, you know, and got seriously injured. And later on, the guy sued that farmer and took away his farm and took away all of his money and absolutely left him poverty-stricken and destitute. Now, every time, and I'm not talking about gun control per se, because there are so many laws now on the books which impede or infringe upon people's personal choices that it's almost unbelievable. But the cause of freedom in the world is suffering enormously, and the United States of America is acting like a spoiled child when we have so many precious freedoms, and it seems like we're being willing to just give them up to other countries. We do business with our enemies. We send wheat shipments abroad because, as Mr. Hubert Humphrey said in an exclusive interview with our television crew for our own program, he said, I'd sell the Russians anything. They can't shoot back. Now, one presidential candidate had said back during the great debate that if the Arabs threatened another oil embargo, that he would cut off virtually everything. Now, it's funny, you know, you take each candidate, each political party, and you can always see a kind of a mixture. I think every American can see that no matter who their champion might be, that they wish he hadn't said something, but they agree with something else he said. You can agree with what one candidate says and disagree with something else he says, and then you can agree with what the other candidate says and disagree with something else that he says. That's the way I felt about it as I listened to it. But I surely would have to agree that if the Arabs, who are living upon an outpouring of American affluence, shipments of American equipment, military supplies, super sophisticated F-14s, Fruent class destroyers, POW anti-tank weapons carried by troops, stuff that we can't even get from our own military units, and then at the same time threaten oil boycotts against the United States, that they ought to in turn be threatened with a boycotting of their food, of their munitions and arms, of their industrial supplies, and of everything we send to them.
This topic will be continued on the next edition in series of The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong. You're invited to learn more about these important issues through the pages of Plain Truth. This International Journal of Understanding comes along every month with a penetrating analysis of world news in the light of Bible prophecy. Correspondents from around the world explain seemingly unrelated events and bring you the good news beyond. Plain Truth. Your subscription is free of charge. There's no cost or obligation. Plain Truth. You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.